Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of December. Our guest the first hour writes in the current issue of Newsweek magazine, last week's tragedy in Mumbai may have finally focused world attention on India's terror problem, but the crisis is nothing new. Despite the enormous death toll since 2004, nearly 4,000 people have been killed in India by terrorist violence and the huge economic and political costs of all the recent attacks, India's government has so far displayed a remarkable sang-froid on the issue. Apart from expressing its sympathy for the victims and promising to prosecute those responsible, it has failed to forge a coherent strategy to curb the menace. Joining us this hour to talk about Mumbai is Shumit Ganguly. He holds the chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. He's been at many other universities. He serves on the editorial boards of Asian Affairs, Asian Survey, Current History, and the Journal of Strategic Studies and Security Studies. And he is the author of India Since 1980, under contract right now with Cambridge University Press in New York, unless it's finished, which it may be. We're going to be welcoming phone calls about Mumbai this first hour of our program today, and here is how you reach us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Shumit Ganguly, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
The news that came last night, reported in the International Herald Tribune, said that Indian foreign ministers had summoned Pakistan's ambassador and told him that Pakistanis were responsible and need to be punished for the terrorist attacks in Mumbai. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there must be at least a shred of evidence to that end. Otherwise, the Indian foreign minister would not have resorted to this rather drastic move, for the simple reason that he and the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, have been at the forefront of a peace process with Pakistan. And summoning in the Pakistani ambassador to read him the Riot Act does not exactly boost that peace process. Consequently, one is forced to assume that there was fairly substantial evidence which induced him to take this rather drastic step.
Mm-hmm. And did you see signs of this right at the beginning or not?
Oh, I most certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
Once the police had managed to apprehend one of the terrorists who was involved in the attacks, and they had ascertained that his nationality was indeed Pakistani and that he had confessed that this was an operation planned by the Lashkar-e-Taiba, an organization that the Pakistani state had carefully nurtured and developed and sustained, then it was simply a matter of time before a step of this nature would be taken.
And tell me more about that group, the Lashkar-e-Taiba. Who are they?
This is perhaps the most vicious terrorist organization operating in South Asia.
Mm.
It is widely believed to have connections with the Al-Qaeda. They were also responsible for other attacks. They have been responsible for other attacks on the Indian state in the past, most notably on December 13th, 2001. Members of the Lashkar-e-Taiba were involved in an attack on the Indian parliament, which then precipitated one of the longest crises in Indo-Pakistani relations.
And the attachment with or affiliation with Al-Qaeda is what?
Largely in terms of fighting in Afghanistan, sharing personnel, being involved in the same training camps,
mm.
And the like.
Mm-hmm. And where are those camps?
The camps are widely believed to be in what Pakistanis referred to as Azad Kashmir or Liberated Kashmir, and the Indians refer to as Pakistani-occupied Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
And also the Lashkar has a substantial presence outside the Pakistani city of Lahore, which is the capital city of the principal Pakistani state of the Punjab.
They have been described as a Kashmir separatist group. Is that a fair description?
I think that is a fair description. I think this is a group that was originally organized, trained, armed, and spawned basically by Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate.
The other news that came yesterday, which seems, you know, in hindsight, how could they not have noticed this, was the ABC report that U.S. intelligence agencies had evidently warned their Indian counterparts in mid-October of a potential attack, quote, from the sea against hotels and business centers in Mumbai. A second government source says specific locations, including the Taj Hotel, were listed in the U.S. warning. What do you know about that?
Yes, and in fact, the Taj did respond to it. They had actually heightened security because Indian intelligence in turn had passed on this information to the Taj and to other hotels. But what had happened is, the irony is, just about a week prior to this attacks, they had finally lowered their guard. Despite that, certain security measures were in place. But the terrorists quite deftly managed to get around many of these security measures by going in through the back door of the Taj. They did not come in through the front, where there are metal detectors and there where they would have faced some barriers. Even if the barriers were not entirely effective, they would have hobbled the activities of the terrorists. But they managed quite adroitly to avoid detection.
Mm-hmm. And some of the initial reports, I wonder if these have been borne out to be true, indicated that some of the employees of the restaurant were involved in this at the Taj.
There is no evidence to that end. And on the contrary, the employees have displayed exemplary courage under conditions of extraordinary duress. Today's New York Times recounts story after story of employees sheltering guests and protecting them and hustling them out of harm's way. It is possible, however, that there were domestic collaborators, people disaffected from the Indian state who worked with these marauders and helped them in many ways plan this terrible string of events.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk more about what you said in the Newsweek piece this week, apart from expressing its sympathy for the victims, promising to prosecute those responsible? The government really has failed to forge a coherent strategy to curb the menace, even though, as you indicate, thousands of people have been killed by terrorism, and it's been going on for quite some time.
Yes, I'm afraid so. The government's entire attitude towards acts of terror has been rather lackadaisical. It is only now, in the wake of this terrible attack, has the government decided to emplace the Black Cat commandos, the commandos who ultimately brought the sieges at the various hotels and the Jewish Cultural Center to an end, that they are now going to have Black Cat commandos located in the four major metropolitan cities of India. I presume this will be Calcutta, Bombay, New Delhi, and Madras, though I don't know for a certainty, but those are the four major metropolitan areas that readily spring to mind. This is something that should have been done a very long time ago. There are no crisis management teams in place, and as a consequence, the response to the terrorist attacks in Bombay took so long. Thirdly, the local police, and I know this personally because I have family who were involved in policing in Calcutta, and so I know this from on a first-hand basis. Local police in India, for the most part, are still armed with World War I vintage bolt-action rifles.
Oh, my.
By the time you actually put a bullet into the breech of this rifle, having fired one, I know of what I speak, and then you discharge that bullet, you've already been cut to ribbons by someone who has a submachine gun, let alone an AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
So they were hopelessly outgunned and outmanned mm-hmm. by the terrorists until 9 hours later mm-hmm. when the Black Cat commandos arrived. And the Black Cat commandos have state-of-the-art equipment. They're equal to any counter-terrorist force in the world.
And why did it take them 9 hours to find their way to Mumbai?
Yes, this is a very good question. It took them 9 hours because, first of all, the chief minister, the principal elected official in the state, was out of the state, and it took an hour and a half to brief him on the full extent of the attacks. I don't know why it took an hour and a half to brief him. That still remains a bit of a mystery and an enigma to me. But be that as it may, it's only then he placed a call to New Delhi to request these national-level commandos. Hmm. When the request went through, the Home Minister, who is the chief law enforcement official in India, in turn contacted the head of the commandos. The commandos were asleep because this was already about midnight in India, in New Delhi. So they had to be roused from their sleep. Then, as they were about to be flown to Bombay, they discovered they didn't have a plane available.
Oh, my gosh.
So they had to requisition a plane from a nearby city called Chandigarh. And so it took about an hour for the plane to arrive, an Ilyushin 76, a Russian military aircraft, which is in India's Air Force inventory. Instead of having a dedicated aircraft, they had to requisition an aircraft. The aircraft took an hour to fly in. Then the people were put on the aircraft, then flown to Bombay. And instead of having dedicated vehicles to immediately take them to the appropriate points where the terrorists had already embarked upon a reign of terror, they were bussed in by state transport buses, which are huge lumbering vehicles, instead of much faster moving vehicles, which should have been in place. But that would have required a prior crisis management mechanism, which didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't there be a prior crisis management system? Is it a lack of money? Is it a lack of vision on the part of the government? What is it?
No, it's not a lack of resources. There was a time when India was a poor country and simply could, you know, was robbing Peter to pay Paul. It was perennially short of money. That's not a problem. It's really a problem of the efficacy of institutions. And as you correctly point out, a lack of vision. There is a kind of an institutional slackness that characterizes many of India's institutions until they are faced with a crisis. Only India is unfortunately a very crisis-driven country.
What about the United States' response to this? We have heard that Condoleezza Rice may be there by now, but it is being sent to the region. Obviously, the United States is worried about this because of terrorism here and the potential of escalating conflict between Pakistan and India, both of which have nuclear weapons. What role the United States now? What's best for us to do, if anything?
We are in a difficult position. We need the Pakistanis desperately as long as we want to prosecute the war in Afghanistan. Because of our terrible relations with Iran, we cannot supply the military, the American military and the NATO forces in Afghanistan through Iran. So the principal supply route remains Pakistan. And because we are dependent on Pakistan for this supply route, we are loath to quickly jump the gun on Pakistan and exert pressure on Pakistan. But on the other hand, we may have little or no choice if the Indians come up with any viable evidence that clearly links, beyond circumstantial evidence which already exists. Well, beyond that, once the Indians can come up with a smoking gun that links Pakistan to these tragic attacks, then I think the U.S. will be under inexorable pressure to in turn induce the government in Pakistan to come forward with the people who orchestrated this horrible tragedy.
We're going to take phone calls, and we'll do that in just one moment. Our guest is Professor Shumit Ganguly. He is political science professor and director of the India Studies Institute at Indiana University in Bloomington. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we have two lines open if you'd like to get one of those. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. www.ideasnetwork.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Tuesday, the New York Times over the weekend published the 100 notable books of 2008, and Harry Schwartz Bookshops here in the Milwaukee area have a list of their bestsellers for 2008. So we will talk, listener request this is, of the notable books of the last year. We go to phone calls now at 800-486-8655. Professor Shumit Ganguly is our guest, and we start our calls with Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hello, Richard.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Now, look, we are Americans, and we are vigorous. We are moral, and we are certainly wise. And we know what the standard of evidence is for pinning responsibility for terrorism upon others. And certainly the Indians have far surpassed any standard of evidence that we have. And so it is certainly the responsibility of our government to explain to India that the only appropriate policy is our policy of preemptive strike. Obviously, the only message that those Pakistanis are going to learn is if the Indians take out 100 or 200,000 people in Pakistan, as is the American custom, and we can forget about other considerations because we know how to use force, and we can forget about the consideration that what we're dealing with here is really a global class war in which the poor are rising up against all the symbols of wealth and privilege, as was the case in the Mumbai bombings.
Professor Ganguly.
I don't think this is a case of the poor rising up against the symbols of wealth and privilege. The poor waiters who were gunned down in cold blood are not exactly the exemplars of wealth. These are working class people who were trying to eke out a living as best they could. The poor commuters in Chhatrapati Shivaji railway station who were massacred in cold blood are anything but exemplars of wealth. So I firmly reject the suggestion of the caller.
Mm-hmm. How difficult will it be? There are interesting reports about phone numbers, that there have been the tracking of some phone numbers. One to Pakistan, Indian officials say that a satellite phone that belonged to one of the attackers was used to call a phone number in the Pakistani city of Karachi during the assault. There also have been cell phone numbers of residents of Mumbai that were found in the wallets and the cell phones of the attackers. The National Security Administration here in the States has said that they can track some of these phone calls, that all of them can be traced. Will it be that hard to find out who exactly did this because we have all this sophisticated technology?
I think at least we'll be able to trace fairly effectively where these phone calls were made and to whom. For the simple reason that the NSA has this capability, and the Indians actually have become remarkably sophisticated in terms of tracking phone calls. Their electronic surveillance capabilities have increased quite dramatically. In fact, the Indian state represents this rather peculiar anomaly. Certain capabilities in India are extraordinarily sophisticated, and yet there are some very low technology gaps, as I pointed out with the rifles. On the one hand, you have a state that is that has superb electronic surveillance capabilities, but does not cannot provide its beat cops with proper pistols and revolvers, let alone submachine guns. Actually, you wouldn't want beat cops with submachine guns. That's a bit dangerous in a major crowded city. But to at least enable them to have proper pistols, which are semi-automatic pistols, like most beat cops here in the United States possess. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, India has extraordinarily good electronic surveillance capabilities, and they, in the past, have been able to intercept phone calls and obtain complete transcripts of conversations.
Mm-hmm. What a striking difference, isn't it?
Sorry, it is. I mean, this is a real anomaly. I mean, it's a bit of a conundrum in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Mike from Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
Hello.
I just tuned in, so this may be a late or a premature question, but I'd like to know in general, what is the objective or the aim of this terrorist group? What are they trying to accomplish, or what is their beef?
A number of different things. One, this was aimed at India's principal economic, commercial, and entertainment center. This was designed clearly to wreak havoc in this major capital along a number of different dimensions. So to instill fear in the hearts of people of the city about how vulnerable they are. At the same time, the second thing is to deter foreign investors and expatriates from moving into this city, to hurt India's significant economic growth. And third, to the extent that we believe that this attack was carried out by the Lashkar-e-Taiba, this represents a dramatic escalation in their activities from merely attacking Indian military and civilian targets in Kashmir, the locus of the of their original goals, to a wider canvas. Attacking vulnerable parts of India.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are they separatists or are they religious?
Yes, they are separatists. But the interesting thing is, the vast majority of them are not from the Kashmir region. Most of these separatists are who are supporting Kashmiri separatists, particularly members of the Lashkar-e-Taiba, are actually from Pakistan and Afghanistan. A handful of them may be Kashmiri, but the vast majority of them, this is a movement for local autonomy which has been hijacked by the Pakistani state. There is no denying that Kashmiris have grievances against the Indian state, and which is why there was an uprising in 1989. But by the mid-1990s, the locals were completely shunted aside by Afghans and by Pakistanis who have no blood-soil relationship with Kashmir. And now, instead of this indigenous uprising, this has become nothing more than a cruel extortion racket.
In what way? Could you talk more about that? An extortion racket?
Absolutely. In that, the Kashmiris had particular grievances. They felt that the original promises that the government of India had made to them as early as 1952 had not been lived up to, that elections in Kashmir were frequently compromised for the fear of separatism, that the government tolerated all manner of corrupt regimes in Kashmir. And finally, a new generation of young Kashmiris who were politically conscious emerged, and they decided that they would take up arms against the Indian state.
Hmm.
That has quintessentially indigenous roots. But after that, once that uprising arose, it was quickly not co-opted, but basically shunted aside by highly trained, armed, organized Pakistani militants who entered the fray and then who just proceeded to engage in mayhem.
Hmm.
Because they have no particular relationship with Kashmir itself. They have no particular affection. In fact, I have known of captured militants who have said, our goal is not to leave one stone standing on another. If Kashmir is my home, why would I want to do that to Kashmir?
Right.
That's the point I'm making about not having a blood-soil relationship with Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
So would you call them nihilists?
Yes, in many ways. I think that's not an inapt description.
Thank you, Mike, unless you had something more.
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Jeff from Eau Claire. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I called about one thing, and then listening, it's just such a deep discussion. I wrote down a couple other questions. I'm just going to read them real quick. I wanted to ask, why can't the Indian Pakistan government work together to confront what seems to be a common problem. And then, based upon the last caller, I wanted to ask if the issues on the western border of Pakistan are separate from the issues in the Kashmir region. And then I just wanted to add an aside, if the guest has heard of the photographer Sebastian D'Souza, who was on scene and took that well-known photograph of the killer that was caught with the gun. And he said that there were any security personnel, but they were hiding and afraid to shoot.
Let me start with the last question first. No, even though I have been following the coverage as closely as possible on the internet, in print, on the radio, on television, that's one that I must confess has escaped me. So I can't really comment on that with any authority. Let me turn to the second question about does this have any relationship with what's going on in Pakistan's western borderlands? Only in part, in that many of the insurgents who are fighting in the western borderlands also have links with the Lashkar-e-Taiba and other insurgents in Kashmir. So to that extent, yes. And then the first question, why can't India and Pakistan work together on what appears to be a common scourge? In large part, because India and Pakistan have a major dispute going back all the way till 1947-48 about the status of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. Pakistan currently controls about one-third of it. India controls about two-thirds of it. In the Indian two-thirds of it, there has been an insurgency since about 1989. You obviously heard my explanation about how that insurgency arose, so that I won't go over it again. Because of this insurgency and because of Pakistan's role in supporting some of the insurgents who are obviously pro-Pakistani and who are quite vicious, India and Pakistan are fundamentally at odds. And Pakistan, for a long time, has encouraged, supported, armed, and trained a series of militant groups, including the Lashkar-e-Taiba, and most notably another one called the Jaish-e-Muhammad, who have attacked a series of Indian targets, not just in the state of Kashmir, but elsewhere. And now the evidence is slowly trickling out that the latest outrage was linked to the Lashkar-e-Taiba, one of the groups that the Pakistani state had spawned. This is why it's very difficult for India and Pakistan to take a common stance against the scourge of terror.
Hmm. Thank you very much for your intelligent call, Jeff. Our number is, one line is open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. Email if you'd like to use that if you can't get through on the phone and have access to your computer is talk@wpr.org. And we go to Mike from Oconomowoc next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks, Kathy. I guess I'm a little bit like the last caller. I started out wanting to ask one question.
Right.
And I ended up
there are so many.
I want to ask another. I guess the question I've got now is in a lot of ways, it seems like the situation that's being presented in Kashmir then is a bit like the situation that is presented to the United States in Afghanistan, which is to say that you have an area that has been, well, at least since partition, has been under significant dispute, that there's been some question as to, you know, the authority that is perceived by local people that are indigenous to the area, and that is the authority with Pakistan, is the authority with India, and in the same way that you have this problem in Afghanistan following the invasion of the Soviet Union. I guess, do you perceive the problem there to be that you end up with these sort of hollowed-out states, and that as a result, You have an opportunity for anarchists and nihilists and people who are promoting the destruction of sort of the modern world to really flourish because of the lack of perceived authority by the indigenous people?
There's a significant difference between Afghanistan and Jammu and Kashmir. Afghanistan had its share of problems. It was poor. It was economically underdeveloped. The regime in Afghanistan of King Zahir Shah had not done a huge amount to promote economic development much beyond the capital city of Kabul. And there are deep historical reasons for this. And the regime was overthrown in a coup originally in 1973. Subsequently, a series of communist governments tried to integrate the rest of the country, promote land reform, and then there was a tremendous backlash, and the Soviets, who had supported this communist government, then moved in. And then, of course, Afghanistan really suffered a terrible tragedy with the Soviet occupation and the American support for the insurgents who sought to overthrow the Soviets. Which lasted for about a decade. And that was a particularly brutal time when the entire country was virtually ravaged. That's a short history of what transpired in Afghanistan, a very thumbnail sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Kashmir is very different. Kashmir, in 1947-48, was already partitioned. Because there was a war that took place almost immediately after the partition of India and Pakistan, because Pakistan claimed all of Kashmir and India was refused to cede Kashmir to Pakistan. And a war ensued with the Pakistanis initiating the war. And they managed to capture a third of Kashmir, which they still hold. Kashmir always has had fairly good political institutions. It's just that those political institutions, while they existed, were also quite corrupt. And the government of India tolerated much of the corruption in their portion of Kashmir. Of course, in the Pakistani portion of Kashmir, there are no elections. Let's not put too fine a point on it. And if anything, the Pakistanis have changed the demography of the entire portion of Kashmir they control by bringing in people from the plains. And thereby, the native Kashmiris have been really marginalized in their part of Kashmir. The government of India, for all its sins, never did that. And in the 1980s, a movement for greater autonomy arose in Kashmir, which, unfortunately, the Indian government dealt with rather harshly. And that, of course, contributed to the uprising in 89, 1990, and one that, and then, of course, that gets hijacked by Pakistan. So these are two very different cases. There are nuances that are quite different. And bear in mind, in Afghanistan, there's not a contestation between two people over the territory, between two hostile countries and that territory. The contestation is mostly internal between various warlords and the regime in Kabul.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, back to what India needs to do to make its country and its people safer, what anti-terrorism measures do you think the Indian government needs to implement today, if not sooner?
Oh, where does one begin? To begin with, improve the lives of the beat cop, improve the training of the beat cop. The beat cop needs better training, better weaponry, more pay to give the beat cop a sense of responsibility and a sense of respect. So the local beat cop is not corrupt. The local beat cop has enough firepower, and the local beat cop can stand up or be alert to potential terrorist threats, to develop crisis management teams that are in place in the event an attack takes place so that you don't find yourself scrambling to respond to that attack, to have a dedicated national counterterrorism agency, which finally the Indians are creating. So at a number of different levels, the problem needs to be tackled.
Mm-hmm. Let's pause for just a moment. We'll return. We're talking about what happened in Mumbai, the terrorist attacks there, and looking at the situation in all its complexity this hour. Our guest is Professor Shumeet Ganguly. He's a political science professor and director of the India Studies Institute at Indiana University in Bloomington. Our number, thank you very much for your call, Mike, and we'll take many more of your calls and ask you to join the conversation if you'd like. One line open at 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, following the news from National Public Radio, notable books of the year 2008. We go back to your phone calls now and to Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I heard that just a couple days ago that the Indian government was warned in October of a seaborne attack against a major city, an attack by terrorists on civilian targets, very similar to what we received in August 2001 before 9/11, that Al-Qaeda was going to attack America in civilian planes. And it seems that the Indian government was the same as our reaction. We didn't do anything. Was anything done by the Indian government first of all, did they receive such a warning? Did they do anything about it? And if they knew about this, why were they so woefully prepared that it took 9 hours for their anti-terrorist?
We talked a little bit about this earlier, but if you briefly want to discuss that again, Professor.
Yes. They did receive a warning, and they did act, and they alerted the hotels about the possibility of an attack on the hotels, and the hotels had taken certain steps. But ironically, just about a week before the attacks, the hotels had lowered their guard. You know, it is costly, it's expensive, it's awkward to frisk your hotel guests. To make
sure
them walk through metal detectors and the like. And consequently, they had lowered their guard. But that said, there are other steps that the government of India should have taken, and they clearly failed to do so. They could have alerted the Indian Coast Guard. They could have heightened security along the docks in Bombay. In fact, now we have evidence that some local fishermen mm-hmm. did alert the police when these marauders landed, and the police basically dismissed the concerns of the fishermen. Had the police been, local beat cops had been alerted to this possibility, then they might have taken the information provided to them by the local policemen a bit more seriously. So there is no gainsaying the fact that there were significant security lapses.
Anything else, Paul?
Yeah, so once their security people arrived, their black cats arrived, why did it take them 2 more days to secure the area?
Ah, that's a different story altogether. There I don't blame the black cats. The terrorists who had holed up in the various hotels knew the layout of the hotels like the backs of their hands. They had carefully engaged in the reconnaissance of these hotels in considerable detail months before the attack. The black cats had to be briefed on the layout of the hotels, which delayed them in terms of their movements. Secondly, the black cats moved with considerable care to avoid civilian casualties. They could have, used howitzers, pinpointed at places where the firing was coming from and simply blown up that part of the hotel. But they knew that there were hostages and they would essentially end up killing substantial numbers of innocent civilians while taking out a single terrorist. So they moved very methodically and carefully. Mm-hmm. But that also delayed the entire bringing the siege to an end.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call. Do you suspect that this was really a massive operation, or were there just a few more than the 10 people who were involved in this?
No, I think this was an operation which involved perhaps no more than a dozen or so individuals who did the actual shooting. But I think there were a much substantial group of a more substantial group of people who helped with the planning, the organization, and the prior foundations of this attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we really need to go after, is the network mm-hmm. of people who supported this entire operation.
And go after that network in what way? What needs to be done?
To use every bit of forensic evidence to trace every phone call, to follow every possible lead, intelligence lead, to see who might, within India, might have been their supporters and their accomplices.
Mm-hmm. We go next to Robert from Grafton. Hi, Robert.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just a little bit confused. I understand that the history has been talked about quite a bit, and I also understand that almost everything I've heard has been about escalation of the weaponry and the thought process. The confusion comes in, this is the land of Gandhi, and out of the many states that found separation, they found it through nonviolence, and here we are speaking about holding somebody, the Kashmiri, because of a war, what have you. I just find it interesting. Why not follow the same beginnings and, like, the British let India go and it turned into two places? Why can't the Indians let Kashmiris make up their own mind? I'm sorry I'm trembling, but I'm in a car.
Okay. We'll let you listen on the radio.
Why can't the Indians let the Kashmiris go?
Mm-hmm.
There's a very simple matter. On the face of it, it sounds like a perfectly plausible grounds to let them go. But the problem is the following. There is no monolith called the Kashmiris. There are Kashmiri Hindus, there are Kashmiri Buddhists, there are Kashmiri Muslims. Not every Kashmiri Muslim even is a separatist. A segment of the population is separatist. The government of India has moral and political obligations to the citizens who are Hindus and Buddhists who also reside in Kashmir. What would happen if you simply ceded Kashmir to Pakistan to the plight of the Hindus and the Muslims? Pakistan started out with a population of 14% Hindus. Today, it's down to 2%.
Oh my.
This is not a country that has the most exemplary record of treating its minority population, let alone its majority population. You cannot simply cede Kashmir so easily. Furthermore, not every Kashmiri Muslim is not only not a separatist, but probably would be satisfied with simply better treatment and autonomy from the government of India. So while on the face of it, it seems a simple solution would be to walk away from Kashmir, that's not, the solution in effect is not that simple. The problem is much more complex and has to be handled with greater delicacy, with greater political craftsmanship, and greater intelligence.
Thank you very much for the call. We go next to Milton from Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. I think that we shouldn't be making final decisions as to where to place blame yet. Anybody who gets their news from more than one source, and we all should, who followed this situation carefully, found nothing but conflicting reports. The final report was that there were 10 terrorists and they're all dead, except for the one who's not dead. And, I saw reliable reports from British newspapers and Indian newspapers that more people than 10 had been captured, including 7 people from Britain. So we haven't sorted this out yet at all. And we need to remember also that Himat Karkare, the Mumbai's head of anti-terrorism, was shot 3 times in the chest during this after he had recently arrested 10 Hindus who did a false flag bombing in September trying to frame Muslims.
All that is absolutely true, and which is why every statement I've made on this show has been qualified about making any final judgment. We have to be circumspect at this point. All I am operating upon is the circumstantial evidence. and the inferential evidence that we possess. This is an ongoing investigation. I am not in Bombay. I'm not an intelligence expert. I'm merely an academic. All I'm trying to do is piece together various pieces of a puzzle and trying to give people the most complete picture that one can, but with the caveat that further evidence, more information, might induce us to change our minds. This is simply a tentative assessment based upon the best available evidence.
Mm-hmm. And how laborious a process will this be to get more evidence that we can point to and say this is the truth? Will it take a long time?
This is going to take a long time, and I only hope that other events will simply not overshadow this one, and the investigation of this event will be then dropped because something else which is more compelling and more immediate occupies the attention of investigators and police personnel and intelligence personnel. I hope that we get a complete and full accounting of what transpired in this tragedy, because we need to learn from this tragedy if we are going to avoid another tragedy of this magnitude in the future.
Right. Thanks for the call, Milton. Mary from Madison. Hi.
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 Good morning. I'm calling because I am planning a trip to India. I plan to leave on the 31st of this month, heading to Delhi, to Agra, Jaipur, so the sort of typical tourist kind of things. But we're also going south to Cochin, and I'm wondering if you think that I am making a foolish move to continue with my
trip. Hardly, for two compelling reasons. One, it is highly unlikely that in the wake of this terrible tragedy, that a similar tragedy will be allowed to take place. There will be a certain heightened alertness, greater attention to security in the wake of this colossal tragedy. That's number one. Secondly, from a moral and political standpoint, I would argue that it's very important for all of us not to be cowed by this incident. Because if we are cowed by this incident, then the terrorists have won. Then civilized life has basically been drawn to a close. This does not mean we don't take reasonable precautions, that we are not alert to our surroundings. But for us to abandon our everyday plans would be an enormous error. I traveled to India in 2002, even though I have a wife and child, right in the middle of a crisis when everyone else was fleeing. And I said, no, it's very important to go ahead with my travel plans, because if one abandons one travel plans, then you're essentially aiding and comforting the terrorists, because they have dictated what you may and may not do. Does this mean you, linger in a crowded railway station when it's no longer necessary for you to stand there? Obviously not. When you see a piece of unaccompanied baggage in a railway station, you don't go and explore it. You promptly alert a local policeman about it. There are reasonable, obvious precautions that one takes. But no, go on this trip. You will have a delightful time, especially on the trip to Kerala, which is one of the most beautiful parts of the world.
Thanks very much. I was astounded by how quickly the restaurant reopened, weren't you? It was within a matter of days people had reopened.
Yes, and also bear in mind that people are already flocking there, which is, I think, slap in the face of these terrorists. The thought that they could somehow manage to break the spirit of the people in this delightful city was obviously mistaken. And this is exactly the kind of spirit that we should applaud and support.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, Professor Ganguly, if your book has been published yet, or is it? Or are we looking forward to that? India since?
No, alas, the book is hopelessly delayed because I get snarled up every time some incident, good or bad, happens in India, and then I devote my time to responding to phone calls and radio interviews and newspaper op-eds instead of working on my book.
Well,
I'm my own worst enemy.
No, you're our friend. Thank you very much for making your time available. It was a very, very good hour. We learned a lot this hour. Thank you.
Well, it's I won't say it's my pleasure, because one can't derive pleasure out of a horrible episode
yes.
like this. But I'm happy that I can, provide some background and sober commentary on a rather grim subject.
Yes, thank you. We'll have you on again. Professor Shumit Ganguly, he is a political science professor and director of the India Studies Institute at Indiana University in Bloomington. And eventually we will interview him on his book, India Since 1980. We thank him for his time and expertise this morning. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we will continue with our Tuesday morning conversation and spend an hour talking about books, always a favorite thing to do. So all of that is coming up. It's a minute now before 10 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.